Welcome to this episode of the Old Casa, your only podcast for detailed breakdowns of the George Lopez Show, episode by episode. I'm one of your hosts, Kyle, and one of my co-hosts is not here today, which of course is awkward because we were actually scheduled to talk about the George Lopez Show today. We were going to talk about the episode of George Lopez where George is being tired and he's unappreciated by Benny, so urging of Annie, he decides to remodel his mother's badly deteriorated bathroom, hoping for a simple thank you. George's plan backfires, and Benny continues to be ungrateful. After a talk, George and Benny realize their significance in each other's lives, in turn, express into gratitude. We're not going to be able to talk about the episode. I swear, every time we plan it, we can't, and now he's not here. So I come up with a better episode, actually. We're going to be talking about the current Kickstarter for Tomb of the Red Horse, and to do so, I'm joined by the creator, Ian and Benjamin. Do you want to go Ben or Benjamin? I should have asked you before I started recording. It was terrible timing.
Benjamin's good. Okay. I like it. Yeah.
How are you guys doing?
I'm good. I'm a little disappointed we're not going to talk about the George Lopez Show. I mean, that was a pretty good detailed breakdown of the episode, and I'm kind of wish I had known that beforehand. I would have watched it.
I've got this folder full of notes.
What's
that? I've been making notes all week on the George Lopez Show, and now just tossing them to the side.
You're not going to get that time back, Ben.
Yeah, it's all right.
Well, yeah, I mean, any time watching the George Lopez Show is time well spent. So I mean, you're fine. Exactly. Do they have that over there, UK? Are you familiar?
No, it's the first time I've ever heard of it. Really,
Are you serious? George Lopez is not a worldwide phenomenon.
Well, it's a staple of the intro of this show, but okay. Yeah.
One of those weird shows. I mean, I don't know if your experience with that, Ian. That's like me and Tim started that, the dumb intro is like, I remember Nick at Night going to sleep all the time and just like waking up with like, low rider.
This is going to give you an idea of the generation gap here, is because I too have Nick at Night memories, but they were basically staying up past my bedtime to watch the 1975 Saturday Night Live season that they replayed, and then staying up just long enough to see if Martin Short was going to be on the episodes of SCTV, and if he wasn't, then I was like, fuck it, I'm just going to bed. So I can't even believe that Nick at Night showed George Lopez. Like, I didn't know that it persisted that long.
Yeah, it stayed. Well, I mean, that was well into, like, I think I was probably in, like, middle school or something, maybe high, but, like, when I was very, like, a lot younger, when I was a kid, because I would stay up late, and then I would leave the TV on, and I'd be, like, woken up by that, like, Dragnet opening, and that scared the shit out of me as a kid. I have no idea why. I think maybe because it was just, like, these are, like, real cases. And I was like, oh, people commit crimes. Oh, no. But unfortunately, we live in a time now where it's much more scarier anyway, so I'm not worried about Dragnet. But speaking of scary, Tomb of the Red Horse, current Kickstarter, officially funded, so congrats on that. That's pretty awesome. How does that feel?
Thank you. Oh, it feels really good. It's one of those things where, like, I think it's fair to say me and Ian were quite confident that we were going to do quite well with it, because we put a lot of thought, we put a lot of work into it, and we were like, yeah, feeling good. But it's just when you actually see that it's hit funded, that's when it all kind of becomes worth it, if you know what I mean. And it kind of, you feel like you've kind of reached that point, and it feels like it's been validated, and you just kind of, yeah, oh, it's a good feeling. It's a really good feeling.
And it was, and it was just a crazy first 24 hours. We were expecting to do good, and we had every confidence that we would succeed. But, like, the first 24, 36 hours was just nuts. It was just really, I think, you know, Ben, feel free to disagree with me, but it was a lot more hectic than I thought it was going to be, just in terms of how well we did in backs and what we ultimately raised in the first 24. So
I remember when we launched it, I just like looked at the page to see if it was up and running, and we'd already been backed like 5%, and I just kept hitting refresh for the next few hours, just like going, oh, there's 25 in 2 hours, and then 50% in like what, 8 or 10.
It was a very, what a day. Well, that was Well, and that was, we decided that we were going to start it at midnight, Eastern Standard Time, which is my time and your time, Kyle. But and the reason we were doing that was because we timed it out, and if we started it at midnight on the day we started, it would end at midnight on Halloween. And we kind of thought that would be a great little tag for the campaign, obviously, like at the height of spooky season, our campaign ends and all of that stuff. But I wasn't expecting it to do that well, like between 12 and like 3 in the morning. You know what I mean? And that was like the really crazy part. I was like, well, we'll get a couple here and there, like maybe 2 or 3. And then I'll go to bed and I'll wake up the next morning. And Ben will, you know, on Ben's side of the pond, he'll have a little bit of momentum and then we'll really start picking up. But like, I didn't go to bed till 4:30 that night because it just kept going off and my phone woke me up at 6 a.m. So, I mean, just strategically, I think that's a great idea. And it also helps me because now it's like I know every day that's left because the days end at midnight. It's not like my days roll over at like 10 a.m. or something.
Yeah, I mean, that when you told me that was your plan, your guys' plan for the campaign length, obviously brilliant. And I mean, I think one of the cool things too is you obviously can see, I think people look at the like pledge goals. So like currently as we're recording, and this will go up this week, but like you're $6,130 out of 5,500. But then you look at something like the actual backers, which I think people kind of always like, I don't want to say gloss over, but like I don't think that's a number, like it's not the number Kickstarter puts forward front forward anyway. But like 256, so that's like 256 people who like vehemently believes in your product and were like excited to back it, and like, you know, that's 256 people who like went out of their way to like back and put money towards like reading your product, which I think is like, even as someone who's like sitting there on the outside, like that's, it's so refreshing and nice to see, because like again, like with the way things are now, and obviously COVID, and obviously kind of where comics are at in publishing, we've seen this big push to Kickstarter, but to see like all these products and campaigns that are currently going on, there's been kind of this big boom of them, but they're all still hitting like hundreds of backers, which is cool to see, because again, that's just like, there's this like, you know, huge number of comic readers are out there like actively seeking out independent properties, which is awesome.
I think it's a bit of the democratization of media now. It's just, it's getting easier to create content at a professional level and disseminate it on a platform that can grow as big as you need it to. I mean, and it's obviously not comics. It's YouTube, gaming, Twitch, all that stuff. And it's just, it's getting easier. And, we just... Yeah, it's one of those things where you get to see its direct interaction. And like, you know, I don't like to say like fans and stuff like that, but it's like 250 some people that believe in the project, and that feels great. And I think you're right. Like, I think Kickstarter does kind of bury those numbers, but those numbers are definitely important to us. I'm sure they're important to all the people doing Kickstarters and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, I think it's something we talk about on the show constantly, because a lot of times we're doing books that we generally believe in and love, because again, it would be an awkward episode if I'm asking questions about a book I don't have any interest in, and it's my show. I'm just generally on here to talk to people like I want to talk to, but like I want to give people money for my things, like, and it like, it's getting harder to do that in kind of the stuff that's generally sometimes put on the stand. So like, to have this like, and maybe a small positive or benefit of COVID has been like the increase in awareness to like, you know, Kickstarters, Etsy product, like all of that stuff has kind of been, I think, a big push. So again, like, I mean, I've found myself even at this point, maybe because I have, you know, a 7-year-old, but like I'm reading like tons of like young adults graphic novels, and I fucking love them. They're like so much fun, and like there's a huge market for that that's like out there, which even then kind of is kind of buried, but like those are some of the books I'm enjoying more than like the big two at this point.
I was just gonna say, like, that's a big thing that I've realized with Kickstarter and like Etsy and things like that in general. I think a lot of people are like, so it's so refreshing to see something that isn't made by a like massive publisher, even though like some of that stuff is still really, really great. I think it's just so refreshing to see so many different voices making something that's truly their own, if you know what I mean, where it's just kind of...
All right. I mean, and I can cut it when he comes back in. But, because, I mean, I haven't, I mean, you talk about, like, kind of the idea of fans, but, I mean, this is the follow-up for you guys, so this is the second one. So, I mean, a lot of those people, I would imagine, are fans who kind of were into the first one, Tomb of the White Horse. And I don't think I ever, yeah, because we didn't do anything for Tomb of the White Horse. I think I was taking a break at the time, but, like,
yeah, I think so.
What was the genesis of that idea? Because, I mean, if anyone doesn't know, like, me and you had been familiar with each other from back in, like, Death of the Comics and,
It was the IC3 Death of Comics days.
Yeah, and then we're both, like, East Coast guys, so we would meet up at New York Comic Con, and then we continued to talk.
You introduced me to Kyle Strom.
Yep, and but we did a show together. It was a Super Comic Battle Wars. But, and additionally, like, yep. You were always, like, you're reaching out and, like, your stuff. And I was, like, a genuine fan of your work. So, like, to see, like, your progression was always interesting. But then when you shared, and I enjoyed all of it, but I'm saying, and I said this kind of early, like, reading Tomb was, like next level Ian, like, especially kind of the stuff you'd always talked about. Like, I remember us walking around Con, you're like, these are the ideas I have, this is the kind of stuff I want to do. And, like, so, like, reading Tomb felt like a culmination of kind of everything you're doing with the anthology stuff as well. Like, how did this idea kind of come about for you? And then I think when we get back, Ben, kind of how did that partnership happen for you guys?
So, yeah, I could start with the Tomb idea. It's crazy. So if I can tell just like a little like story, like, to kind of like lead into it's the story of which I'm sure a lot of people know, but it's the story of Kevin Smith and the movie he did, Tusk, where there was a brief period of time where I was listening to Kevin Smith's podcast. I think it was Smodcast. I'm not sure which one, but I listened to the episode where they were talking about the article about the guy who was looking for someone to impersonate a walrus, and then the whole episode spirals into this potential horror movie about a guy turning someone into a walrus. And then, like, four or five episodes later, Kevin Smith comes back and he's like, "You're not going to believe this, but I actually wrote a script," right? And then, of course, you know, Tusk comes out and it's like, I actually haven't seen it, and, like, I'm sure it's either good or mediocre or whatever, but it was just so crazy to me that, like, there was, like, a live recording of the inception of that idea, and that you could literally track that idea, like, through the podcast and through social media from its very inception to its completion when it was released. And that, like, blew my mind, right? And then I was just like, what if there was, like, a video recording of George Lucas, like, when he first said the idea of Star Wars out loud? And you could trace it from that all the way to... Anyway, but that always, like, fascinated me. And one of the things about Tomb is that, like, I can kind of do that. Like, I remember being, I remember where I was working at the time. I was at work and we were talking about Twilight Zone episodes and we were kind of going over our favorite, and I watched, like, so many of them with my dad. And my dad's favorite episode is called The Howling Man, and it's about basically these monks lock the devil in a closet and this guy lets him out, and then the end of the episode is he gets him locked in another closet. And he's going out to, like, arrange for transportation back to the monks. And there's a cleaning lady there. And, of course, the cleaning lady lets him out again. But just, like, that you could trap something in this box, right? And then that people could accidentally open it was, like, the impetus for Tomb of the White Horse. And then it just kind of, like, grew over the course of that night to, like, a ghost story that, like, I just, like, I couldn't stop talking about. And I just kept saying it over and over. Like, all right, there's, like, these guys and they're at a warehouse. But it's, like, remote and it's nighttime. And it just kind of built from there. And, you know, we had the idea, I you know, worked with Ben fleshing that idea out. And then from that, like, we kind of realized, like, well, what would be in this thing, or what could it be? And then the idea of kind of turning it into a biblical horror story, which was, you know, like, which is tied to the concept, but it's not actually, like, I don't want to say, like, biblical apocalyptic horror, because it's only kind of tethered to that in, like, a very tangential sense. But the ability to tie it to that and then expand it and then say, well, if the Horseman of Conquest is in here, well, then we'll have three other tombs and then we'll have three other stories. And it's better to not have these stories intersect, so we'll do an anthology style, which is another huge thing that I'm into, going back to Twilight Zone and Tales from the Dark Side and Tales from the Crypt. So it was just, like, this kind of, like, perfect mixture of all of these things that we wanted to do. You know, like I was raised in a secular household, so like the Bible was always, you know, not mockingly or degradingly, but always kind of regarded as the same thing as like Lord of the Rings or anything else. So like, you know, the New Testament is like, you know, high fantasy to me. So being able to mix that, like those high fantasy elements with like a really, really good ghost story, along with, you know, with kind of anthology horror, and then being able, and then kind of growing out of that, kind of turning it into a statement kind of on like where we are in America right now. I mean, maybe in the subtlest sense, it was just like all of these perfect things coming together.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that's, I think one of the most amazing things about that, the first issue, is like reading it, you get kind of the touches of all of that from you and Ben. Like, I mean, it feels very much like, obviously, like The Thing meets, like you said, kind of this biblical horror, but also like there is the isolation element, and then there's the, you set such like real grounded characters in this short issue, which is amazing in itself. But like, this is like a lot of touches of horror in that, and kind of numerous things, and then to have it kind of culminate in that first issue ending. And if you guys had never even, you know, continued the project, I think as a standalone, like, again, like kind of like anthology Twilight Zone type thing, like it works perfectly, which is amazing. But then, like, I remember reading it, and then, you know, kind of having that thought of like the, I was like, the multiple tombs, like as it continues, like it's just like, even in your mind, like I think it is just fun after you finish that final page to like just meander off and think about like where it's going.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, obviously that was by design, because, you know, if this was the only one that we did and it ended up just being this by itself and nothing else, then it could stand alone and not. And also because I think there's, I think it's difficult to pitch a Kickstarter where you're pitching an issue two or an issue three. And not that people shouldn't do that, because I think that's great. And I know I have friends that are doing that. Jeff Ryder is the first one that comes to mind. And I think that can be done really well. It's just an added difficulty. This is essentially, we're selling stories in a continuing saga that relate, again, like loosely to one another. And we'll, when read together, we'll kind of, you'll see a larger picture. But it's kind of easier to sell them as individual stories, especially when you have new characters, which then becomes tough trying to write, you know, a full kind of three-act story into, you know, one issue without making it, you know, 45 pages.
Right. That's a challenge in itself. I mean, and I think it's interesting to a lot of people that kind of, at least I think now you see a lot of, like, kind of the track people make into comics. I think these, like, growing anthology stuff has been really great because, again, like, the hardest stories to write are, I think, anthology stories, because it really forces you to focus on, you know, storytelling, characters, and a clear, like, through line. Whereas, like, I think a lot of people make the misstep of thinking their first comic is always going to be, like, this grand, epic, like, sci-fi, fantasy, opera, which, like, I think everyone a lot of times wants to tell, but, like, you know, setting that off as your first thing is very difficult, because I think most people don't have that that ability or understanding of how to tell that, and more importantly, it's getting like kind of that first story done. And a lot of times, like, those anthology comic settings are really good kind of, like, you know, building grounds for people.
Yeah, so I've had this big kind of like coming to terms with existentialism and the absurd, like, over this year. Like, it's obviously been like a terrible year for everybody. I'm assuming most people, like, unless there's any, you know, billionaires listening to this podcast. The thing is like, you know, knowing why you're doing things and doing them for reasons that you want to do them is important. And then also realizing, like, you know, as you were saying, that, like, yeah, it's like, you know, my first work might not be my best work. And I think one of the best things I can say about Tomb of the White Horse is that when I look back on it, like, I don't cringe. Like, I'm happy with this. Like, I feel like I did well here. I know I can do better, and I feel like Red Horse is better, and I feel like I have the script for the next story done and edited, And I think that, like, that's even better than the previous two. So I feel like I'm moving in the right direction. I think that's what's important. Just being happy with what you're putting out as well, but also realizing that you can always do better is the key. Just
Yay! Sorry about that, basically.
That's okay.
Hey, buddy.
My Wi-Fi router decided to do an update. Yeah,
basically. So, we just talked about George Lopez for 20 minutes.
Oh, man. I just threw away all my notes. I have to go outside.
Yeah, we don't have time to talk about it anymore. I wanted to we touched on kind of the evolution of the story and then kind of how you guys got together. And I was talking also about last thing we were talking about was like kind of the initial track into comics. A lot of people now are like doing like, you know, the anthology of kind of like breaking your teeth on that and being able to tell a concise and clear story, and how that has progressed into then people telling like cohesive like first issues and stuff like that. And I think that's been a great thing as to people who kind of set out in their first story trying to tell this like epic space opera and then just get hung up. I mean, for you coming into art and comics, where, like, how did you start? As for like, were you originally working in the medium? Were you doing like painting or graphic work, or like how did you kind of work into the sequential settings?
So like way, way, way back when, like when I was just a little boy, my like big ambition was to do, because I assumed they'd still be making these books when I grew up, but I really wanted to do the Goosebumps covers. Like, I just thought those paintings were absolutely amazing, and I was like, hell yes, if I get the chance to do these, that would be amazing. So I like kind of just drew and drew and always drew like kind of relatively spooky stuff. As I kind of got more and more into art, I kind of drifted more towards painting for a little while, and like a lot of my influences with that have kind of bled out onto what I do today. Like a big influence of mine is like Francis Bacon and things like that, and like Egon Schiele. But then when I went to university, I kind of went with illustration, because it like that the kind of course brief kind of resonated most with me. It was basically what you'll do is you'll take an idea and then expand it visually through whatever means you possibly can. So it's not kind of kept in by style, or it's not kept in by like a certain format. It is just trying to visually express that idea. So I was really drawn to that. Whilst I was there, I kind of tried out a few different things where I was just always looking to see how best to kind of serve whatever idea I had, if you know what I mean. So rather than just going, I'm going to work in this style for the rest of my life, I was like, well, this idea I think would come out best this way, things like that. For those 3 years, I kind of just operated under the assumption that I was going to go into editorial illustration, so for like magazines and newspapers and things like that. And it was only in the last year, I forget what project I was doing, but I was like, oh, this would be really cool if I did it as if it was a 2000 AD comic. So I kind of picked some up. I picked up a trade, it was like the Judge Dredd collected case files, picked that up, and I was like, why have I not been doing this much longer? Like, why haven't I not been doing this for years and years now? And really got back into comics through that, and then really got back into the idea of sequentially telling a story. So kind of, yeah, just breaking it down rather than trying to conceptually tell it in one image. Like, yeah, just kind of playing it out as if I'm a film director, but I'm in control of absolutely everything within it. And I think that's really exciting when you're making, like, when you're telling a story or making something, is kind of going, right, well, with this, we can also move people's eyes around. We can change the lighting, have any camera angle whatsoever. So that just really excited me. I think it's really fertile ground to tell any kind of story whatsoever. So I started making loads of comics. Then after uni, kind of, I did my running, like my running pitch. I sent my portfolio off to 2000 AD. Got sent a very polite and informative rejection letter, which I framed. And then, just kept on working, worked much smaller. And so, like, yeah, the first few comic kind of works that came out that I did were, like, really, really, like, short stories, like, 4 pages. And even in that first one, you kind of learn, you have this big story in your head, as you said, like a kind of space opera kind of thing. And if you limit yourself to 4 stories, then that really just gets down to the heart of what you're going for. It like makes you tell that story concisely and effectively. And so, yeah, started with those and then kind of have just tried to build up a little bit more each time.
Which again, I think like with visual storytelling approaches is then, I think that, like you're talking about that kind of mindset and then taking that to a page and focusing on that specific page, that specific panel, that like what is going to visually tell the best one. I'm looking through the first one, Tomb of the White Horse, and there's the one page where they're arguing in front of the tomb, and it's like on the top right there's the dial pad, and then as it goes down, the like shadow of the vault, the tomb, is like splitting them, and then you have like a black line running in the background as well. Like it's so visually pleasing to like see that, see them kind of reflected in the pad as well, and then kind of have this like split, and like you have the two people in the foreground in shadow, and the next panel like the tomb's in the shadow, and like just like kind of overwhelming like doom and dread behind them. It's like so well done. And obviously, I mean, Ian's words are, they're okay, I guess, but it's the visual setup for these is so great. And I think that's, you know, both of you do an amazing job of kind of setting the tone and mood for that issue specifically. It is amazingly well set.
Well, thank you. I think a lot of that, yeah, it does come to Ian's writing as well, because the way he writes, I haven't seen it in a huge amount of other writers that I've worked with. I haven't read too many scripts from like a huge amount of other people, but when I read Ian's scripts, it's very much like you feel it really viscerally when you're reading it. It's almost as if like it fully forms in your head. It doesn't have like super strict directions of like, we're going to see this and this and this, and we need this angle here. But you kind of, the way he writes it, it kind of like punches you in the gut, and then you have to just go, right, let's see. I think that's what kind of us two kind of combining the way we work, it makes it, yeah, really, really like emotionally hefty.
God, I'm going to have that played on a loop in my tombstone. Thank you so much, Ben. But I think also, you know what it is, I mean, and I do strive really, really hard for that, like where I want to give you the basics of what you need, but I also want to leave enough room for you, to visually interpret it in your own way. But I also think that my one strength is being smart enough to understand that when you work with someone like Ben, and he's like, he proposes a panel change or a scene change, or when he says, I think I'm gonna, we can do it like this, you just say yes, right? Like you just, it's truly like he is the director of the film, right? Like, and I'm the writer, but he is the one representing it visually. And it's like, I, you know, knowing like his level of talent, it's just kind of like, I trust him implicitly to do whatever he thinks is best. And I, you know, I don't want to start an argument or anything, but I don't think I've ever fought you on anything as far as like design changes go. I'm like, you know better than I do, right? Like, and a lot of the times that represents so incredibly well when I see the pages finalized. We're not going to give anything away, but Ben, the I can't remember the page off the top of my head now, but the page where you're showing the horse statue in front of the casino.
Yeah, yeah.
that like was one of those things where I that page looked a certain way in my head, and I'm like, it's going to look great. And then when I saw the thumbnails and when I saw the roughs of what Ben was doing, I was like, this does not look like I thought it was going to look, but it also looks like 10,000 times better. And it's one of those things where, like, I just, you have to trust the people you work with, and you have to work with, you know, people that, you know what you're doing. Also, I think talking helps a lot too. Like, there's so much you can convey over email or through scripts, but I think the fact that Ben and I, you know, chat on Skype and stuff like that, I think also like says a lot. It's a lot of it's about communication.
Thank you so much, man, for all of that as well. That was really, really nice. Yeah.
Oh, no worries, bud.
And you kind of referenced this in like the bringing up like kind of the goosebumps and kind of that ability to establish like even seeing those, I think any of us like at this age, like there was such a tone and feeling as you go into those. And I think again, I reading that first issue, like you guys do such a good job of setting the tone and dread, and like horrors, and we've talked about this a bunch because we do a lot of horror comics because it's something me and Tim enjoy a lot, and I think it is very difficult to do in comics for the many reasons of, like, you know, controlling the pacing of the reader. You lack kind of sound, there's a lot of stuff that you don't have that you either have with, you know, movies, but then even like prose, because of the lack of images, you really play with like what people kind of visualize in their head. So like comics, you're kind of, I think, handicapped in some way by the way you present it, but you guys again do a fabulous job of that. And then even that, like the kind of horror you guys are establishing in at least the first issue is like this like cosmic horror dread type setting. So it's really a lot of building tension. How did you guys kind of want to approach that with the issue, and then even kind of going forward with Tomb of the Red Horse? Like, what is your approach to kind of building and establishing like quality horror that you guys have done in this first issue?
Well, at least on my end, I think Ian and I have like a good crossover in our like horror influences, but we also have like some distinct differences as well. Especially whilst when I was like working on White Horse, like I was very much into my kind of like more down tempo, like kind of quiet horrors almost. Like It Follows was like a very big, like it was one of my favorite horror films at the time when it was happening.
I was just about to say, yeah.
Yeah, where it's like, it's that slow burn horror that the dread doesn't leave you from like the second that you know like what the stakes are and what's happening. And that's kind of what I wanted to seed in here, where like things are just going to be off kilter for a long while, and it's going to get uncomfortable and more and more and more until it's unbearable, and then you release it a little bit on a splash page, and then it just keeps going again and again.
And I think the other thing is about the transition we've made from White Horse to Red Horse is that we've definitely kept some of the dread, I would say, and obviously the terror, but Red Horse is a much more kinetic script. There's a lot more going on. There's more than one setting. So we're doing a different job, but we're trying to keep it like we're still doing construction, but we're working on a different part of the house almost. I don't know if that's a good analogy. Probably not. But what do you think, Ben? I mean, you think it feels different to you, right? Like it feels faster to me. It feels more brutal in parts, obviously.
There's a lot more buildings in it.
Okay.
Yeah. No.
A lot of geographically specific specific buildings. Yeah.
No longer in a big warehouse.
You can't draw boxes. Now you have to draw like towers and pyramids.
Yeah. But no. I think it's a very different tone. It's almost like I kind of look at the Tomb series as a whole, and I won't spoil what we have in store further along the line, but I kind of look at them as different horror films. And this one is kind of like the, it's the kind of quite tight budget, small cast, not huge on the special effects, kind of psychological horror. Whereas this one, it's as if there's like, I don't know, a bit more at play. It's a lot of the threat is, I'd say, is a lot more present, but it still has that kind of, it still has that hand on the wheel almost, where things are still in control and it's not going straight into everything scary all the time. There's, I kind of am finding it quite difficult to explain, but, you know, the like quiet bubbling dread that was in Tomb of the White Horse, it's now kind of reached its boiling point in Red, but it still has that kind of, still has that control to it, I'd say. Yeah.
Right, there's a lot of, and again, yes, it's more kinetic. There's a lot of running in Tomb of the Red Horse. There's more, let's just say, action, I think, which is kind of by design. We wanted to take these stories and make them each one larger than the last. You know what I mean? Like we wanted to take it from like sort of like state to country to continent to planet in terms of like, you know, the magnitude.
Which I think is really smart, and especially what I enjoy a lot with like the horror anthology movies. What you got like with Tomb of the White Horse, that clearly works because at that point you guys are kind of establishing that. So the building of tension and kind of that bubbling like undercurrent of this like, you know, biblical or cosmic horror, like that works because like, I think smartly, you guys don't explain anything in that first one, really. Like, it's, and that's, you know, I love those type of stories. But with the end and kind of the release of that tension, like, to go to a second issue and try to, like, restart that for readers would be, I think, difficult. And maybe, I don't, like, it wouldn't work as well. Whereas, like, if you, you know, pivot to the horror in a different style of horror, like, you know, that more kinetic, or like if, like in movies where they, like, they may do like a body horror and the next one's like a slasher, like it works because then it resets readers versus like forcing them to reset in their mind and be like, oh, I got to reset this tension, even though, like, you know, the tomb's going to open, like it's going to be this different thing. Like, I think smartly, like changing that up works effectively for the horror.
Yeah, I think that I mean the best example that I could give it's again, I'm not trying to compare us to this, but the difference in terror that you feel between Alien and Aliens, mm-hmm. right? It's where they are the same, but they are the where you get your terror from is entirely different. You know, where it's just one thing, or this kind of stalking and slashing. To just you're overwhelmed by this army that, you know, doesn't obey any rules and won't listen to reason. So yeah, I think that it's a matter of, like, we didn't want to have a book where we didn't want to have the second part of this book be these people find a box and then don't understand what the box is, and then the box opens up and it's bad, right? Like, telling the exact same story four times just is reductive and kind of pointless. So the idea is to make these incidences more fresh. And, you know, now that I'm saying it, like, it kind of reminds me a little bit of World War Z. And it's almost like it's an oral history of, like, these four incidents that are going to happen. And we're kind of getting a ringside seat for them. And they're all going to be different in terms of magnitude and character and what happens and how these phenomena present themselves. But, you know, they all don't end with the tomb opening. You know, I think this one's going to be a lot different, and then what follows after this is going to be different as well.
I wanted to quick, I think, two things, because I, for anyone listening, kind of, you know, inside baseball, Benjamin has been very nice to record with us, and I think it's like one I don't fucking, it's too late for
it's
him.
It's like 2 a.m., right, Ben?
It's 2 a.m. now, yeah.
Yeah. Two quick questions I wanted to cover, like, you know, kind of broadly the Kickstarter, like, roughly, like, you know, what is the goal for, like, kind of the incentives for backers and then kind of the timeline for you guys. And then also, I think maybe before that, I did want to highlight the kind of team on this one, because I think first one, amazingly, like the colors were, was it Leslie Atlansky, and then Zach Sam on letters, and then the beautiful covers from Kim Mayette. But on this one, you guys have additional team with, I'll let you say, because I'm going to butcher.
It's Durfla Kelly and Hassan Otman Elhu, colors and letters respectively, and we've got Kim back on the cover as well, which is fantastic. And also Claire Napier edited the script and gave some phenomenally great notes that really helped shape it.
Claire was amazing, and Danny Lohr did the script editing for Tomb of the White Horse as well. Yeah, I mean, we're at this point, we're fully funded. Kyle, do you know when this is coming out?
This will be out this Friday.
So it's going to be this Friday. So at this point, there's going to be like 9 days left in the campaign. We're already fully funded. At the time of the recording, we're just over $6,000. So our first stretch goal was for $6,000. Our goal was $5,500. We made our first stretch goal like very easily attainable, and we're going to be doing a making of Tomb of the White Horse and Tomb of the Red Horse like digital booklet. So we're going to have, I think, like annotated scripts, process pages. We're going to do early sketches. We're going to do the early version of Tomb of the White Horse that, you know, we shopped around a little bit, but ended up kind of scrapping. What else are we putting in there? Did I miss anything?
No, that's about it. The early sketches being like concept art for various elements that reveal themselves later in the book.
Yeah. I think we're also going to do interviews. We're going to do a couple of interviews and maybe add some digital goodies in there and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The $8,500 stretch goal is kind of unique. We're budgeting the $8,500 stretch goal to get both of us page rates for the book. Where everyone else gets paid, Ben and I are doing this, for the love of the game. So $8,500 is going to get us a reasonable page rate. But the big one is, if we can double our goal of $5,500, if we can hit $11,000, everybody who backs the book is going to get a digital copy of Tomb of the Black Horse for free.
That's crazy. Obviously, I think that's, a really unique and fun idea. I think this is something we're kind of seeing a little more of. Obviously, like, kind of when the Kickstarter kind of initially started, I don't think a lot of people know how to approach it. So we joked about this on a lot of the Kickstarter ones we've done. I have so many fucking stickers. My kids' like backpacks and like binders are covered with all these like Kickstarter stickers I have, because you get like, it's always like an incentive, and I have them, and I'm like, I don't know what to do with them. I don't use stickers, so like, that's something you see a lot. But like, at this point, like, again, getting people, like, having that extra money go to like the actual creators, and then not only get page rates, but then the incentive of paying them more, you know, cover it. Like, getting people actually paid for like the extremely hard work and time they're putting into it, I think is, as a fan of comics, I think is an awesome incentive of itself, and a great way to kind of give money to people and then actually have that money go to them, which has been cool to see.
Go ahead, Ben.
I was about to say, we've recently popped on, we're utilizing Kickstarter's new add-on store feature as well, and we've popped on more rewards for the book. It's not stickers, thankfully. It's we've got a limited run of little lino cut prints that are like hand carved and everything like that. So it's more, I'd say it's something that you could just have like as part of your collection of like something on the wall and things like that. And then we're adding on the pins as well. But it's like, I think we tried to go for a bit more of a leaner reward base in general, because we didn't want to kind of just have our focus being like all over the place, like going, oh, we need to get these postcards, we need to get these prints, we need to get this sticker pack, we need to do this, we need to do that. So I think it's really helped out, and it's like the kind of Kickstarter that I want to back as well, where it's like, I'm not going to have a load of stuff that I'm going to put in a drawer and then forget about.
We wanted to keep it simple for sure. Yeah. The line of cut prints are phenomenal. They're all there's only 20 of them, and they're like individually stamped in foil. They're so neat. I think Ben's got like one original page left. Like, I'm still amazed that that hasn't been snapped up yet. And I think Ben's got one original sketch still left up available. I'm doing script edits, I think I've got one of those left. And of course, like, we're doing an enamel pin that's going to be designed by Blackie Shepherd. There's like a ton of really good stuff. We're going to add the enamel pin, like Ben said, to the add-on store as soon as we release the design and all that stuff.
Right. And so I will... Normally, Tim has a final question. It is normally terrible. So I have my own question that I've tailored, but... because I will generally I will wait for whatever reason to my weird OCD. I had a plan originally, and it fell apart because of when you guys were funded. But I will, as we record, I will back it.
Are you backing it right now?
I'm opening up
right now.
Oh my goodness. This fulfills my lifelong dream of seeing how long of a delay there is between someone backing it and me getting the notification.
Yep. So I just, pledge.
You're too sweet, Kyle.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Exciting podcast where you can say, all right, I see the confetti. And I see Ian's side smirk looking at me. So it is funded. Normally Tim asks questions about the Big Bang Theory. He's not here, so I'm going to skip it.
I've listened to episodes of the show recently, and I don't remember the George Lopez thing, and I also don't remember the Big Bang thing. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think we do it. The only ones that I don't do it on are if it's by myself, and I did one. Done a couple recently, I think, where that... or if it's someone I am super afraid to do the George Lopez open. Like, I was talking to Ben before we started. I had last month did one with Steve Yowell, like, from Zenith and 2000 AD. And I was like, I'm not fucking doing a George Lopez joke. This fucking guy, he's, like, nice enough to take his time. I'm not doing that. Not to say you guys aren't.
It's funny. I loved it. I thought it was great. I felt stupid for not realizing it's, like, a regular thing.
Yeah, well, it started out because, like, I've talked about this, but I hate the name Pages and Panels. I've always hated it, but 5 years I've been doing the show now, like, I can't change it, and I just originally picked it as, like, a placeholder, and it's stuck, and I realized I can't change the name because, like, it fucks up, like, SEOs and stuff, so I'm stuck with it. So, like, as a joke, we started doing that where I don't have to say the name, but me and talked about in the beginning, me and Ian used to be kind enough to join me on this show where we would pick, I think it was like 3 or 5 of our favorite issues of the month, and we would talk about them. So it's Halloween, spooky season. For you guys, what is your top 3 horror movies? Don't have to be in any particular order.
Ooh. May I?
Go, please go.
All right. I like People Getting Lost in the Woods quite a lot. So my top two, number one would probably be Ritual, that came out in 2018, the Netflix film.
The monster design is so good.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. And I really, really like that kind of, that type of horror where it's really dealing with something completely different, like, throughout, if you know what I mean. It's like, the horror is almost like a secondary thing where, it's dealing with a lot of grief, a lot of guilt, and a lot of feelings. A classic that I absolutely love, which I think is kind of held up, is Blair Witch Project, just because I give it props for, like, doing a lot for found footage and kind of feel bad for everything that happened with found footage afterwards. And then the third, Ian, you say some things. I can't think of a third right now.
Jesus.
Oh, no.
This is such a big question. Top, okay. We're talking top three horror films.
Yeah.
The Thing, John Carpenter. I don't know. The Fly.
And I mean, I none of them are wrong. I think these are all.
I think, shit. I don't know. I have trouble with the third one as well.
I just brought up my letterbox to try and, like, find if I've, like, set anything aside for it. I mean, The Witch is great. Like, yeah, I guess that would be my third. Yeah, potentially.
Yeah, I feel... But that's the problem, is because there's so much good, like, new horror. Mm. But horror is one of those things where, like... You know, it, like, comedy, sometimes it has a shelf life. You know, like I... So, like, I, you know, I could say Mandy, I could say Hereditary, I could say, The Witch, I could say maybe The Lighthouse, because The Lighthouse is super crazy, but I don't know, I keep coming back to, like, old stuff. Like, I mean, Prince of Darkness I love, but I don't know. Yeah. I feel weird they have two Carpenter movies, like...
I think, dude, that's why, I think that's the interesting thing about horror, and maybe comedy as well or anything, but, like, I think within the genre, there's so many, like, subgenres. Like, it gets tough because, like, I mean, the same thing, like, you know, found footage, I love, and, like, Blair Witch, The Thing, but, like, even, like, then there's something, like, Hereditary where, like, I love that movie, and it was, like, one of the movies that hit me the most. Like, I was physically, like, uncomfortable when I watched it, to the point where I don't know if, like, if I have want to watch it again. So that makes it fucking awesome, but I was like, is that, like, there's so many, like, different, like, types of the genre that it gets tough to, I think, narrow it down to, obviously, three, so it's a, you know, a loaded question on my part, I guess.
But I think also, too, it's, like, it would be so easy to rank three, like, what are your three favorite popular horror movies? What are your three, like, you know, most underrated, because there's, like, there's just so many that mean so much to me. Like, and I don't even know if this is a horror movie, but when we were kind of planning Tomb of the Red Horse, Benjamin and I talked about this movie that I love called Miracle Mile, which is, like, Anthony Edwards, like, gets a phone call from a payphone. Like, he intercepts a random phone call, and it's this kid. It's, like, the middle of the night in La Brea. And, the kid's calling from a missile silo in Colorado, and, like, the Russians have launched their missiles and we've launched our missiles, and it's, like, 4 hours until the nuclear holocaust or whatever, and like, it's him trying to get his girlfriend and get out of the city, and spoiler alert for a 40-year-old movie, like, everybody dies, the nuclear bomb goes off and everyone blows up, and it's just, like, it's horrifying, but it's, like, I don't know if I'd call it my favorite, but it's because it's so obscure, but, like, man, it's definitely powerful.
I'd say my third. I'm changing my third. Sorry.
Oh, fuck. Yeah. What's his third?
I'd say it's Misery. It's a film that I watch every year, and it kind of, it's one of those oddly comforting but still completely uncomfortable. Like, I like the ritual of watching it once a year. Every single time, I feel like I have a physical reaction whilst watching it. So I've seen it, like, loads and loads of times now, but every time, like, I curl up on the sofa on the run up to that hobbling scene. Oh my god.
Yeah.
Oh, love it.
I haven't seen that in so long. That's James Caan's best movie.
Yeah.
Oh. Man, that's right. I gotta check that out again. I'm like that with The Thing. I watch The Thing, like, easily once a year, sometimes more.
Yeah. Well, I didn't think of before I'll let you guys talk about where we can find stuff, but, like, in the, like, kind of the way there can be different types of horror. I'm trying to remember what it was called. It's like Jeff Daniels. He, like, lives next door to Tim Robbins, and, like, Tim Robbins is, like, plotting to blow up a government center. And it's not, is it Mulholland Drive? No.
Do
you know what I'm talking about?
I think I do know what you're talking about.
But so the whole thing is, like, he suspects that Tim Robbins is, like, extreme, like, domestic terrorist, and, you know, he feels like he's going crazy, and, you know, no one believes him, and he studies terrorism, and he's a professor.
This is like the 90s, right?
Yeah, and in spoilers for the, again, this movie, like, you know, Tim Robbins was, his whole family is this, like, you know, right-wing extremist group, like Timothy McVeigh type thing, and they blow it up, essentially, like, pinning it all on Jeff Daniels' character. And, like, so the end of the movie is, like, you know, this, like, you know, he dies in this explosion, and Tim Robbins' family, like, gets away with it, and, like, everyone believes, like, you know, Jeff Daniels' character was this, like, person who was, because he studied terrorism, he was like, so like this whole thing where, like, that fucking, like, freaked me out as a kid to no end, obviously, like, with domestic terror, but, like, the idea that, like, you know, someone could plan this whole thing and, like, alter, and, like, it's like a thriller movie, like, I don't know if it's, like, classified as, like, a horror, but, like, with me, it sat for, like, a long time, I'm watching it, and, like, it just, like, freaked me out. But I think that's one of the great things about horror, and to tie it back, I think, again, like, especially with the first Tomb, like, you read it, and then, like, obviously there's the impending horror and the stuff you guys reveal at the end, but even, like, the shit that goes on with the characters, like, is, like, generally, like, you know, life horrors, like, things these people dealt with, and then where it all culminates. So I think, again, what you guys do with that issue is amazing, and I'm very, very excited for the next one.
Well, thanks, man.
Thanks, man.
Where obviously is going up, the Kickstarter will be running, where can people go to the Kickstarter, and then if they want to find out more stuff from you guys specifically, where could they do that?
Well, for me, for the Kickstarter, go to tombcomic.com. That's TOMBCOMIC.com. You can also search for us on Kickstarter at Tomb of the Red Horse. I'm on Twitter at Ian_face. That's like the easiest place to find me, honestly. And Ben, how about you?
I'm mostly on Twitter. It's username Bayfilby, BAEFILBY.
And because I'm terrible at it, I always forget we have to have actual guests remind us all the time. We're at pages_panels. Apparently we have a Patreon. I occasionally remember to mention that. We do a weekly show on that. If you're listening to this, at least the day it comes out or around that time, on the 24th, we're doing our live comic book club. For the spooky season, we're going to be talking about the Image comic Infidel. So you can join us live. It'll be streamed on our YouTube channel. But we'll be talking about the book and some other spooky stuff, I guess. But mainly kind of a book club about Infidel, which I've reread twice to get ready for. And that book's fucking insane. I don't know if I can effectively talk about it because it's way smarter than I am. But it's fucking great.
Yeah, I think that movie you were talking about was Arlington Road.
Fuck, that's it. Yeah, I was confused with Mulholland Drive because they're both.
But it's not. It's not Jeff Daniels. Mulholland Drive is fantastic. It's not Jeff Daniels. It's Jeff Bridges.
It's the other one. Jeff Bridges. Fuck.
They're basically the same guy. One's the Big Lebowski. One's the guy from Dumb and Dumber. That's the only difference.
But the most important thing, if you listen to this, is to go back to Tomb of the Red Horse. Again, it's already funded, so you're backing it to get it. Like, you're already going to get it. And like I said, Tomb of the White Horse is fucking him. Yeah. But like I said, I genuinely was so in love with Tomb of the White Horse, so I'm so excited. So I appreciate you guys taking the time, and especially Benjamin, to be doing it from the dead of night to join us. So I appreciate it, guys.
Hey, no problem. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much, Kyle.
Yeah. Thank you so much for backing us. I think we pushed us over to 111% as well.
We're there. We're moving up, man.
That was my goal. I told Ian my goal. I had been watching the Kickstarter like every, like, 2 hours. I refreshed because I was like, I want to be the one to go to the 100%. And you guys were at 98%, and then, like, I checked back, like, 30 minutes later, and it was, like, 101. I was like, fuck! Oh. And then I was like, all right, well, I'll back it, and I was like, I'll save it. So, yes. And that's this episode. Next time Tim will be back, I'm sure we'll be talking about George Lopez at that point. I know I'm saying that for 40 episodes, but we'll get to it.